I want to think about the pity of God for his people. We'll start with Joel 2, verse 18. Yahweh will be jealous for his land and have pity on his people. I want to follow through this idea of God having pity, that in the end, God did pity his people and will pity his people. Perhaps a key verse also is Malachi 3:17, and I will spare them. It's the same word for pity. I will pity them as a man spares or pities his own son. So then, the parental feelings of a parent who has to discipline his child or her child are the feelings of God for his people. Now, Israel and Judah had really sinned against him. He had warned them multiple times, and eventually the judgment did have to come. It was self-inflicted, really, by them more than him inflicting it upon them. But God pitied them, as a man pities his own son. As I say, Joel 2:18, he will be jealous for his land and pity his people. In fact, the NEV has that in the past tense. Yahweh had pity on his people. When you come to a chapter like Ezekiel 5, you wonder how on earth that happened. Because there in Ezekiel 5:11, God says, "My eye will not spare, neither will I have pity. I will have no pity," the NEV says. And when you follow through the logic there in Ezekiel 5, saying that I'm going to destroy a certain part of you by the plague, by the sword, by famine, and then just a minority of you are going to pass through the fire, only a minority will come out of that, and out of that, only a minority will be preserved. Those of you who go into captivity, I will send a sword after you into captivity. And in Ezekiel 5, it's talking about what happened really at the time of the Babylonian sacking of Jerusalem. But he says, I will not pity you. And yet, Joel 2:18, Malachi, he will pity them. He did pity them. So what really happened? Well, if you look at my commentary on Ezekiel 5, you'll see all the academic references to this, and I'll spare you for the moment. But you can check it out if you doubt. The Babylonian policy about deportation and management of conquered lands is actually preserved. They didn't believe in actually deporting in a mass sense. They, unlike the Assyrians, the Babylonians didn't practice mass deportation. They just removed the leadership and they appointed local people as leaders under their control. And that's what they did to Judah. It would be a textbook case, really, of Babylonian policy. They took the royal family and the leaders of the priesthood into captivity and set up Gedaliah as a kind of puppet sort of governor. And they made Mizpah rather than Jerusalem the capital. And that's sort of confirmed in Ezra 9 when we read there, verse 7, our kings and our priests have been delivered into captivity. But the record says that they left the poor people in the land. Now, it's been estimated that probably at least 90% of Judah were peasant farmers, and the impoverished masses were left. They were not deported. You know, Babylon didn't want a load of peasants rocking up in Babylon. That was not a cool idea at all, and so they didn't do that. And so the people were not scattered. Yet Ezekiel 5 says, I will not pity, I will send a sword after you into captivity. Well, okay, they got to Babylon, and yes, they did hang their harps by the rivers of Babylon, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. But that is not at all how it remained, because by the time of Esther, the Jews were wealthy. They were in positions of power and influence. All right, they'd assimilated very much, but Mordecai, as a form of Marduk, was there working in the king's palace. And the book ends with the Jews popular. And, you know, Haman says, I can kill all the Jews and give a huge amount of money into the king's treasury if I do, because they were wealthy. It's as simple as that. They got on very well. So the sword didn't really chase them into captivity, nor were the majority of them destroyed, as Ezekiel 5 requires. And there's archaeological evidence that there was continued agricultural activity in the land after the deportations by the Babylonians. In other words, the whole scenario there in Ezekiel 5 of plagues coming upon the land, wild beasts taking over the land, and the majority of the people perishing in plague, at the edge of the sword, by fire, etc., they just didn't actually happen. And in Jeremiah 41, verse 5, you read about men coming to the Jerusalem temple in order to offer grain offerings at the site of the temple. And again, there's archaeological evidence that the temple was not completely destroyed. There was still some structure left standing, and certainly the floor plan was still evident. Well, perhaps the altar had been destroyed. That's why they bring grain offerings and not animal sacrifices. But clearly, there was still some level of worship there. And it's been suggested that the Book of Lamentations was actually part of a sort of temple ritual or material that was recited at the site of the temple during the limited amount of worship the Jews could do there. But they still did worship there to some degree. So how do you square that with the descriptions of judgment? Well, God is serious, and yet he is also not a literalist. And he, like us, has this tendency, this dimension of pity within him. He had said all this, but in wrath he remembered mercy. I suppose you could argue that there were perhaps a minority who repented, led by the prophets, under the likes of Ezekiel, and therefore God ameliorated the judgment, just as he did on Nineveh. In 40 days, Nineveh shall be destroyed, but it wasn't because there was repentance. But that is certainly not recorded. The implication of Ezekiel, his whole prophecy, is that he did not make any converts, and he's told that at the beginning of his ministry, that he's going to have a ministry that's going to be a tough one because he's not going to convert anybody. So I'm not that crash hot about the idea that some repented and so the judgments were ameliorated. I think rather that this is the case of Joel 2:18. Yahweh was jealous for his land and had pity on his people because, Malachi 3:17, I will spare them, I will pity them, as a man spares his own son. This is God's degree of pity. This is no contradiction. This is not God's prophetic word failing. This is the God who is not ashamed to say, yes, I said this, but the pole of my pity for my people is, if you like, greater than the pole of, shall we call it, my necessary judgment. And you see this all lived out in Hosea. You know, he marries the prostitute Gomer, and she was unfaithful to him, and he's angry with her, he threatens her with judgment, and yet he still keeps on loving her. This, as I say, is a picture of God's feelings towards his people, and he says, my repentings, my changes of mind are kindled together within me. So the true God, the one and only true God, is not the stone-faced, stone-hearted gods of the Greeks who cannot have emotion. That is what makes you not a god, according to Greek theology, to have emotion, to have passion. Well, the one true God, Yahweh of Israel, is full of emotion, is full of passion. And you see this throughout the prophets. And this God is our God. And this is the wonderful thing, that he fully enters into our situations. He does relent. He does have pity upon us. Even when we're passing through necessary judgment, even when we're passing through consequences of our own foolishness, he does have pity. He really does. And so should we. If we end up legalistic people who say, well, this was the punishment agreed, and that is the punishment that will be, this is the discipline agreed, and so it shall be. Justice must be done and seen to be done when people fail in their relationships with us, either personally or in a collective church sense. Well, I'm afraid, have you known God's pity in your own life? Have you, as one of God's beloved children, felt God pitying you as a man pities or spares his own son, as we read in Malachi? Because if you have, you will not be like that. You will not be a literalist. You will not be a legalist. You simply won't. And this God is going to be our God right up to the day of judgment. This is him with whom we have to do, as Paul would put it in Hebrews.